Welcome to the Honeycomb Podcast. We're bringing you a special collab with Visa Wellington on a Plate to present the Wellington Food Story Speaker Series, taking place at the Museum of New Zealand, Te Papa Tongariro. In each episode, you'll hear about Wellington's unique past and present food stories, as told by Wellingtonian chefs, historians, and storytellers. On this episode, we're talking about Wellington's present dining scene with Steve from Taste of Home, Rick from Soul Shack, T from Little Penang, and Tom from Tommy Millions.
Kia ora. Ko te ahu mairangi te moanga, ko paikawakawa te awa, ko seramiku taka ingoa, no te whanganui atara aho. Kia ora. Good afternoon. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Sarah Meikle and I'm the Festival Director of Visa Wellington on a Plate. And it's my pleasure to welcome you all here today for the final instalment of the Wellington Food Story Speaker Series presented by Te Papa here at Te Marae. I'd like to thank Lauren Campbell and Ian Crowe and the Te Papa team for their huge support for making this happen and this series possible. This series has taken us back in time into Wellington's restaurant and dining scene, and we've explored early Wellington and the sources of kai around the harbour, talked about the early days of coffee in the Dragon Roastery and Alexander Turnbull, and last week we reminisced about the heady days of the 80s and 90s here in Wellington. To round off the series and to lead us into the future, we're going to hear from owners of iconic Wellington establishments who've come to define Wellington's present-day food scene, top quality and accessible everyday eats. Leading our discussion today is Sam Scott. Sam is a celebrated musician through his passion and passionate opinions of food, has found himself an accidental food journalist. Aside from composing music for films like Hunt for the Wilder People and Boy, performing for the Phoenix Foundation around the world, he's written about underground ramen pop-ups for cuisine, and his dream is one day to be friends with David Chang, who I think we all want to be friends with. He does want to move to New Zealand, so it's a good start. So I'd like to welcome Sam, and I'll leave him to introduce you to our panellists today. Enjoy. Kia ora.
Kia ora, thank you, Sarah. It's wonderful to be here in the beautiful Marae and with four chefs, restaurateurs, who I've eaten a lot of their food, and I'm really fanboying out here. I'm feeling very nervous. I don't want to mess anything up because I don't want to be banned from any of their establishments and ruin my life. But I have from Soul Shack, Rick Unuia. I've got Tom Curtin, or Tommy, from Tommy Millions. I've got Steve D'Souza from Taste of Home, and we've got Tifi from Little Penang. So really, four places that, when people come to Wellington and it's like, where do I go for lunch? These are the places we all talk about over and over again. And, I like to joke around when I'm talking with people from Cuisine Magazine and stuff that the best restaurant in New Zealand is Taste of Home. So that's my... Who needs a table for it to be a restaurant? You know what I mean? It's just I can stand outside on the street eating a bowl of noodles, and it's my go-to. So anyway, I'm going to leave it up to you guys to introduce yourselves a bit more and tell me a bit of your food story. I think we should go around a bit and just talk about who we are, where we're from, what led us to food in the capital, and then we can get into a nice informal chat just about the Wellington food scene and about what makes food everyday food. Because that's really, I don't know about you guys, but that's my favourite part of the food scene. I mean, I love a good tasting menu. I love a good, share plate, fancy spot with nice ceramic plates. But I don't love them anywhere near as much as I love somewhere where you go all the time with your friends and have a great, reasonably priced, wonderful food experience. So should we start with you, Steve?
Oh, sure. Thank you. Well, thank you for having me here. I am Steve. I run Taste of Home with my partner Tina for the last 3 years. We started Taste of Home as just cooking at home, and because we used to both work in fancy restaurants, and then we used to come home and just always think, what to eat right now? And noodle was always like the go-to option for us. So yeah, that's how we started, and then we kept on building on what we were supposed to do, what we can add, and yeah, that's how we just started. And we love to travel and try different foods, and that's pretty much it.
Right. T?
Hi, my name is T. I'm from Little Penang, and Little Penang was set up as a small takeaway 9 years ago now. Can't believe 9 years have passed. Mm. Yeah, Beth. Beth was with us when we first had the little tiny takeout on Dixon Street. So now we have two restaurants, one on Victoria and the other on the terrace. And basically the reason why we started Little Penang was, firstly, to be honest, like it was out of boredom because I used to be in the corporate life. And when we migrated here, my husband was still working and both the children are, you know, at school. So, and just like you, we think about what to eat, where to eat. And unfortunately, with due respect to the other Malaysian restaurants, when we first came here, we found that it was not what we have back home. Like we don't have cauliflower and broccoli. Those two are really expensive vegetables back in Malaysia, but they have that in the noodles. So we say, okay, let's try something, you know, to bring something to Wellingtonians and the migrants in Malaysia who are missing out, because I did a lot of home cooking and friends were just saying, oh, why don't you just start something so that we, you know, we don't have to come outside your house and wait all the time to be invited, you know. So, yeah, so that's how we started Little Penang, because we wanted to bring Penang. Penang is a state north of Malaysia and it's very close to Thailand. So we have a lot of Thai influence as well. And specifically, we decided to focus on street food because that is what Penang is popular for. So, yep, in the cheese.
I had a lot of that old-style Wellington Malaysian in university and I loved it, but I didn't really realise until, you know, until going to Little Penang and then travelling a bit more and learning a bit more about the world, that what I was eating was Wellington Malaysian influenced food, you know, it's his own sort of simplified cuisine. But then Little Penang, I remember when you were the hole in the wall place going there, the first time I went there, I was just like, oh,
this is how it's supposed to taste.
This is a different world. This is something really amazing.
Yeah, especially now that we know people travel a lot, you know, people are really exposed and they're, more discerning when it comes to food. And I think we have to respect, firstly, our food, our tradition. And we also have to respect our customers, so we keep the tradition. Thank you.
Tommy?
Kia ora, everyone. My name's Tommy. I am the owner of Tommy Millions Pizza and Lucky Chicken. Tommy's has been around for 8 years now. We've got two stores in Wellington. It was born out of my first passion, obsession with pizza, particularly New York-style pizza, which I picked up while I was traveling around North America, staying up too late, drinking too much, going out and eating slices of pizza late at night, and decided that that's something that Wellington could use and needed, and there was a real gap for it. So got obsessed with pizza making, nurtured that, ditched the corporate career, which was a very short one.
There's a pattern forming.
Yeah. I think it's quite common amongst probably all of us, yeah. Tommy's was born out of NYPD, which was the precursor, a market store we had at the Harbourside Market for 5 or 6 years, a little trailer, wood-fired oven, that grew into Tommy's. Several years later, I got my second obsession, which was fried chicken, particularly fried chicken sandwiches or burgers. That grew into Lucky, which started as a sort of offshoot inside the first Tommy Millions and has since sort of flown the coop. And has we have a second store on Willis Street and hopefully plans for more.
You've got so many chicken puns. It's amazing.
Well, you've got to weave them in delicately.
Yeah, he was saying before off mic that there's a pecking order here amongst the chicken burger.
So Rick has worn the appropriate shirt here, and you'll hear soon that he is indeed the Alpha Chicken of Wellington.
Alpha Chicken. Rooster. So, yeah, tell us your story, Rick.
Yeah, I'm Rick of Soul Shack. So, from a corporate background as well, amazingly as well. Yeah, but I came from the feeling that I just wasn't going to enjoy corporate life very much, so I wanted to start my own business. And probably about 5 years ago, it started from a waffle truck, actually, called the Hot Waffle. So I was kind of in that whole food truck boom that was very exciting during a lot of the Wellington on the Plate events that we had. Anyway, I opened up a shop in Porirua, probably about 5 years, just a little kiosk, and quickly learned that waffles probably weren't going to sell a lot as a lunchtime fare, so I just had a look at the market around me. I just thought, oh, there's a fried chicken joint there, there's a fried chicken joint there, there's a KFC across the road, and I thought, oh, I'll do my own fried chicken and waffles. So I started playing with bringing my waffles with the fried chicken and just experimenting with all different types of fried chicken, like buffalo and Alabama white sauce. And I stumbled across Nashville Hot Chicken and followed a page over in LA called Howling Rays. And I just thought, oh, it was just amazing. Like, and I ended up messaging Johnny Rayzone, who's in LA. He has like 3 hour, like all day wait times and stuff for his chicken. And I just messaged Johnny. I just said, oh, look, I'm doing natural hot chicken over here. This is kind of how I'm doing it. And he was just like, yeah, happy to help. And he was just kind of tweaked, gave me a few ideas, gave me the range of scope, what natural hot chicken should be. I also reached out to Morgan McGlone of Bell's Hot Chicken, and he was just like, yeah, and he was able to try some of my spice, and he just loved it and thought it was legit, and just gave me the confidence, really, to start in Wellington. And then we started up in Reading. They got shut down, and then we started outside Goldings, and then we couldn't stay for so long. Went to Fortune Favors, only so long while the shop was being built, and now the shop's kind of just going off in Dixon Street, and hopefully we can just stay there for a year. And the running joke at the time was, when's the shop going to be built? When's the shop going to be built? And I always told people 2 weeks, we're going to be 2 weeks. And it went for a year. And then we went into the shop, and then 2 weeks, COVID hit.
Right,
and then
yeah. It was like, so what you mean was the shop will be open for 2 weeks.
That's right. That's exactly what I meant. So, cool. And then we did quite well, and we survived through COVID. I just think if anyone can get through, like, you know, these guys can, and the Wellington scene as well. So
it feels like, you know, chefs... they have to be resourceful at the best of times to kind of make things work, because it's such a fast-paced, cutthroat, you know, just things go wrong and you just got to keep going. You have to kind of keep this sense of calm out the front while in the back everyone's really, you know, just busting to get things done. And so it's really shown the resourcefulness that I think restaurants have built up naturally, that so many people have managed to survive what's, you know, been just, it's really affected, you know, restaurants more than any other industry, really. And it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what happens next internationally. But I think in Wellington, we're very lucky that we can all be out and about and eating now and enjoying the sort of, yeah, enjoying a semblance of normalcy.
For sure.
But it's amazing. You've both learned from kind of masters in the game. You've both reached out to people who are those cult figures within that food style. Like Tommy,
I probably should have mentioned that throughout my training I spent a bit of time going back and forth from Wellington to New York and San Francisco, and similar to Rick, had just reached out to my fanboy Pizzaiolos that I looked up to and just said, can I come and work for free? And some ignored it, some said, if you actually get here, are you serious? Yeah, sure. So I turned up to their door and they saw that I was indeed serious, and they're generally pretty keen to have some free, strong-backed Kiwi labour in the kitchen and start to share their secrets. So I went back and forth. Most famously, Paulie G's is a really well-known pizza shop in New York that I had a couple of stints at, and A16 in San Francisco, so well-known Neapolitan restaurant. And through those avenues, I found it to be the shortest road to true knowledge. You can read books, you can watch YouTube clips, which I'm sure we all did plenty of as well, but the hands-on experience in top flight kitchens around the world is really the shortest path that I found.
I mean, because I've reached out to David Chang to
ask David.
Joe was like, can you put me on TV? I just want to be a TV star. Can you make that happen really quick? And he's just never replied. So tell me, T, I'm interested because Little Penang is such an institution in Wellington now. It's a place that people go to, you know, people who work in the city might go there for lunch a couple of times a week, or they'll make it a destination place to go to for lunch or for dinner. But it's somewhere that people keep, they get their favourite, you know, they will have the Nasi Lemak and they'll be like, well, I always get this particular curry or that particular curry, and they become very particular about their Little Penang order.
Yeah.
So what's the secret to everyday food, and what do you think keeps people coming back to a place, you know?
Yeah. Okay, so we do have customers that come in. We still have customers back from day one until now, 9 years. And so are you not sick of the food? But I think firstly it's the consistency and the quality that you have to keep up, you know, in all your food. There are customers who are habitual. We find this a lot in Wellingtonians. Though they are quite happy to just come in, I'll have the mee goreng. You had a mee goreng today, like yesterday, and I'm bet you're going to have the mee goreng again tomorrow, but that's what they want, you know. And there have been a few times I took the challenge and say, okay, why don't you just try the char kway teow for today?
Yeah.
And they did, and then they got stuck on the char kway teow for months.
Yeah.
You know, so I think,
I can relate.
Yeah, so keeping to the consistency and also I think making it affordable for people to just come in as if they're just going back, you know, to a canteen or to a mum's place. Do you pay when you visit mum? Maybe not. Yeah, you know.
You pay in other ways.
Yeah, in other ways, yeah. So I think to make it affordable and accessible is really important. That's why we have been wanting to move on to more variety of food, like our traditional food. Definitely that takes a lot more time and it's not like a fast, like, you know, how people want it here, especially in the CBD terrace. They all come in between 1 to 12, you can have like 200 covers just in that 1 hour.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you have to be quick to meet their timing.
And you've had to keep changing your premises to meet that demand, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. My husband said, that's it.
Is that your stadium now?
Yeah,
the new one's pretty big.
Yeah, the new one is pretty big, but I think, yeah, there's a lot of time and effort because for me, I just believe that we have to be there as, you know, owners and operators to support the staff, to be there for the customers and to make sure your quality of food is there all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so franchise people have been asking me, I said,
keep the quality up.
Yeah, keep the quality. And yeah, we started the terrace because a lot of customers have been asking us, you know, they work on that site. They take a bus down, pack the food and go back. And so, yeah, you know, estate is really expensive. So we'll just keep it as terrace and Victoria.
Okay. Now tell me, Steve, because you've got such a small site. Yes. It's remarkably small, but it is so busy and it is such a cult hit. And like, I mean, I ate a lot of hand-pulled noodles when I was living in Auckland for a few years. And I don't think any of them live up to Taste of Home. It's such a remarkably good noodle place. It really just feels just like it's always spot on. But how do you cope with the fact that there's these queues and this crowd, especially like post-COVID? Do people mind being crammed in the small space? Do you think about expanding or trying to do things differently?
Well, post-COVID, obviously people know how to keep their distance and, you know, always sanitize, keep clean and everything. So I've never really bothered with that aspect of things because people know, okay, it's a small place, they place the order and they go out and say, in the open space. But it's pretty good after that. And I definitely thought of expanding, but then again, with like how T said, that you have to be there to make sure the quality is there.
Mm-hmm.
So because like Tina and I are always there in the shop, we always there to make sure the quality is good.
Yeah.
And
tell them how you're close today because you're not there.
Yeah.
Are you close today?
Yeah, we are here, you know, and Tina's away
I'd
in
I'd like
China.
To apologize to the people of Wellington. <I know. laughs>
Yeah, a lot of people are missing out on lunch.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I always tell people to go. I've quite often got friends in town who are in other bands and they're like, okay, we've been here for the weekend, we're leaving this afternoon, where should we go for our lunch? And I'm like, oh, you got to go to Taste of Home. And then they text me 20 minutes later going, it's shut on Mondays. I'm like, oh.
Yeah, we had to do that because we were working like crazy hours.
Yeah.
Because it's so small, we cannot really prep and cook at the same time.
Yeah.
So we do service, then clean down, and then we start a prep. So it's like a really long day.
Yeah,
it's
the hand-pulled noodles, I expect that's real time-consuming.
Yes, we do that in the mornings or late night. It's like it's early mornings, around 2 o'clock. Or in the morning around 6, we do it. Yeah, so all these things do take time. So, like, we've changed our menu quite since we started. We had only 5 dishes when we started, but all of those 5 dishes were really time-consuming. So then we, like, kind of changed to something okay, like not too complicated and easy to push out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm really interested in, like, with restaurants that are the everyday restaurants that have through the street food influence in terms of like providing something for everyone, which these days is quite often it's about gluten and it's about vegan and vegetarian options. Maybe I'll start with the Chicken Lords. Tell me, Rick, have you been thinking about, I know you're saying you've got a cauliflower dish that now people are getting in
the burgers. I mean, the truth is the market kind of demands like something lighter, or like generally there's a vegetarian kind of option there. So I like to kind of have products in the shop that we can kind of utilize in different ways. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you know, for example, like we're doing our gumbo burger at the moment. So, you know, I want to be able to translate that into something that would be our fat fries, like our loaded fries. So the same thing applies for something like cauliflower or yeah. like the slaw or something like that. You know, we want to be able to use that cauliflower in a way that is not just as a side. We want to be able to use it as a main as well. So we've had people come in and ask, like, you know, oh, can you do a cauliflower burger
yeah.
and stuff? And we've done that. And generally, at the moment, it just gets so busy that sometimes we can't really cater on the fly and stuff.
Right,
if the people generally come in a bit earlier, and people get wise to us as well. They know when the peaks are and when to come in and when not to come in.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we have some very just particular customers who come in, and as soon as you open the door to them, like, they just, you know, they know exactly what, like the cauliflower burger. Oh, can you put that in the burger? And can you add the level 4 to the fries and all that kind of jazz? So, yeah, I think it's just, yeah, we want to be flexible. And I am actually looking at, I had a burger from Mexico. I had their vegan burger with the Beyond Meat stuff.
Right, yeah.
And stuff. And actually, that was really, like, that's a revelation to me. Like, I mean, I'm just like, I'm not like all about meat and stuff, you know, in my head. I'm just like, I like trying new experiences.
If it's a good product, then...
Yeah, yeah. And it tasted fine to me. Some people were like, oh, it's not meat. I was like, well, yeah, okay, cool and stuff. But like, man, that'd be really good on a loaded fries. You know, like I just chop it up and like, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, you know, I like food because my whole... philosophy is basically I look at towards the Black American soul food,
yeah,
and that's kind of where the core belief is as well. Like, I just look for food that's going to make me feel good, and whether that is vegetarian or whether that is meat and stuff, that's kind of where my aim comes from and stuff. As long as it hits the spot. I mean, our burger is really like a heavy burger at the moment for Wellington on the plate. So, you know, we don't want you to go and get a cheeseburger later on. You know, we want you to kind of just, you know, be satisfied with whatever fare we're doing. So, yeah, vegetarian options are there. We just kind of want to incorporate them in a way that will satisfy people at the end of the day. So, yeah.
What about you, Tommy? You do a lot of vegan pizzas, right?
Yeah, we do. So that is part of the business, which has grown massively in recent years in Tommy's. In the early years, we were able to remove ingredients to make things vegan, but it was always sort of an underwhelming sort of facsimile. But we started actually having a specific vegan pizza on the menu, which now changes month to month. And I thought it would be a pretty slow mover. But there's days when it will outsell pepperonis, like sometimes 2-1. It's crazy. If there's a special on that really sings to people, it will absolutely move. And it seems the vegan community are all connected in some type of messenger service.
Yeah.
And they're all in each other's ears. And on the first of every month, we have a queue waiting to see what that month's special will be. So that's been a really interesting exercise and really pushed the business in a direction that I didn't expect it would have gone in.
Yeah.
But then there will always be, like Rick touched on, that balance of being, trying to be everyone to everyone, everything to everyone, and sort of potentially losing something in that process.
Yeah.
So we had, in the early years, we'd allow all sorts of customizations and swapping ingredients from one pizza to another and ending up with these hybrid beasts that might not work too well or might not be able to be repeated if that customer came in and had had a different pizza maker the next time. So we sort of started to draw a line on some things while opening the door to others.
What about celiacs and gluten-free customers? Because I mean, I feel like there's not many ways you could functionally serve that, really.
Exactly. So literally 2 weeks ago, we drew the line completely on gluten-free bases. It was never an official thing on the menu, but we did have them available for large catering orders. The thinking being, you don't want an entire group to miss out on an order just because, you know, to lose the entire order because you couldn't cater for everybody. But the practical reality is that we cook in an environment that's filled with flour. I mean, my sheets are filled with flour, my shower floor is filled with flour. There's flour everywhere. And we just couldn't guarantee against the cross contamination and the safe cooking.
We found that when I was doing waffles and stuff, that was one thing that we got constantly as a question was like, oh, do you do gluten free waffles? And I mean, it's not it was a question where you go, oh, well, are you just irritated by gluten or are you completely allergic? And because there was a whole gluten kind of like almost trend against gluten and this people were almost kind of like becoming, it was really hard to differentiate. So we just drew the line. I just said, like, we're just not going to do gluten at all because yeah, someone might be irritated, but if you get somebody who passes on, like, oh, they don't do gluten, they do gluten-free, and it happens to be someone who's allergic,
who's celiac, yeah,
then it's just not worth the risk. And I just look at the market.
Then you need a different deep fryer or a different
stuff. You need almost a completely whole setup and stuff, yeah. So I would need another truck almost to do waffles. And it was the same, yeah, with fried chicken and stuff. We just thought, like, no, you do have to cross, you know, just, yeah, unfortunately, for those who... you know, who are allergic to gluten, you just can't really do it. But the cauliflower, though, we can use cornflour in that. But I mean, like, but at the same time, you know, you want to manage the risk. So, you know, whether somebody could just, you know, it's just a management of risk. And yeah, at the end of the day, it was just easier for everyone involved, I think. Yeah.
So you were saying that you grew up with seitan.
Seitan?
Is a really old method of making gluten-free food.
Yeah, this is a very old traditional method of soaking flour in water and then running it slowly through water to just wash out the and get the gluten. Yeah, so without realizing it now, back when I was growing up, which is like many, many years ago, we had a lot of our diet actually related to the traditions and the festivals that we have. Like, we have a lot of vegetarian food, not just because of health, more so for religious reasons. Like, family was Taoist, you know, so we have on the 9th, which is in September, the Festival of the Hungry Ghosts. And ironically, everybody goes vegetarian during that time, you know. So we were very creative in making food that are vegetarian from starting. And we have like vegetarian roast duck, vegetarian roast pork, fish, everything. And they look exactly and taste like the same thing. Now reflecting back on my childhood, because I remember my grandmother's 80th birthday. I was still a little kid, and we have to wash like almost more than 100 kilos of flour. And I was sitting there and like, what? I don't like this. I hate this. Why is my life so bad? But so. And it was a technique I learned without realizing the value it has today.
Yeah, and you're just doing the mise en place.
Yes, and we had an 8-course dinner, all home cooked, for 100 over people. 8-course dinner, and we have steamed fish. We have fried prawns, roast duck, roast goose, chicken, and all that. And I was like, it actually looks like the real thing, you know? So it's just because for us, I'm sure for everybody else, it's not just eating with your palate, it's eating with your eyes, you know? So on reflection now, it's amazing that we have been exposed to that tradition without really appreciating and valuing it until now. I mean, yeah, you know, so... We do have a lot of vegetarian options, like at Little Penang, because we use a lot of rice. So gluten-free, vegetarian, a lot of our things, we are versatile to change that to vegetarian when we can. Obviously, there are some very traditional street food, like prawn noodles. You can't, because you need pork ribs and you need the prawn shells to do that. So
That's how you get the base flavor.
Yeah, you need the stock. So, yeah, so, but...
Are there any dishes you would like to serve that you think the Wellington customers would find too unusual, or is the Wellington customer base quite open minded, or are there things that you?
Yeah, definitely. I think they're definitely very. We have been doing this for 9 years, street food, but we have come to a stage where we want to introduce our traditional food. Like, we have specific food for specific occasions, like confinement. You know, if you're a lady who has just given birth, we have certain type of food to build up your body again. And then we have food for Chinese New Year. We have food for birthdays, like noodles and all that. Those are all, it's tradition, but the food is tied down to, you know, the festive occasions that we have. And that is the story behind why we serve that. Like Chinese New Year, we are definite to have fish, because fish is prosperity and longevity and being versatile, you know. And meat, of course, back in those days, meat were a luxury to us, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of things we forage ourselves, the vegetables and things like that, and fish we just go to the seaside and throw our line and eat whatever we catch, you know. So pretty much, I'm learning to live with what you have. And this is the trend now, you know, foraging So we have come to the stage, we are going to introduce what we call the long table, the tok panjang. So it's a tradition for nonias like us to have a long table where we have all the dishes spread out and everybody just come and join to sit.
All right, yeah.
Yeah, to eat. So we are going to introduce a little Penang, but it has to be occasional because we want it to be accessible. We continue to be accessible, so we still have our street food and all that. This is a bit of free advertisement.
I'm good. I want to go, so this is good.
But I think it's time for us to share the story, the actual stories behind our food and why we have this dish during this occasion and all that. You know, we have so many festivals. Almost every month, we have a special festival. So, so I think we're looking forward to do that to Wellingtonians, especially now that a lot of you can't travel. So, just come over to Penang.
And tell me, Steve, like, were you surprised at how quick Wellingtonians were to pick up on the Sichuan noodles and, you know, pretty spicy, pretty new, quite new flavours for Wellington, I thought.
I was surprised on how spicy people in Wellington can actually eat.
Yeah.
Like, everyone goes for extra hot. I'm like, really?
I don't.
It's pretty good. And we also, because dandan noodles are quite popular.
Yeah.
And we also tried doing that with green jackfruit. Like a vegan substitute, because we don't want people who don't eat meat to miss out on it.
On that,
So it's actually quite nice. And we try to get our spices from China whenever we go back. Like when I go back to India, you know, get a few spices which you don't really get over here.
Mm.
Yeah, and I feel that is what makes it kind of different. You get that little oomph that, you know.
Yeah, when spices, you can taste when you go to a place and they've got better quality spices because the flavors are just so pungent.
Yes, definitely.
Definitely.
Do you have any dreams of introducing Indian dishes or anything else to the menu that
we were planning to do that, but then when we renovated our kitchen, we kind of stuck only to like noodle dishes.
Yeah.
So we don't have space to add anything else at the moment.
Yeah.
But we're thinking of trying to do like a curry style noodle dish, but then, you know, like braised chicken or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
I was amazed to learn that there's a big influence in India of Chinese food and this whole Chinese-Indian kind of crossover.
Yes.
Yeah.
You don't call it Chinese, you call it Indian Chinese.
Indian Chinese, yes. Yeah.
We call it Chindian.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. There's so much more diversity and ideas spreading, you know, through Southeast Asia and South Asia. And, you know, I think we don't know about the diversity and interaction of those different cuisines in the West. We've quite sort of we like to compartmentalize it a little bit, and then also we just want these types of dishes. We just want Cantonese Chinese dishes, or we just want Malaysian. We just want roti bread and a, you know, a coconut based curry or something. But you know, I feel like chefs like you are really, you're opening people's palates, and it sort of leads the way for other places to experiment with, you know, something different as well. Have you noticed a difference in the Malaysian food in New Zealand since you started?
I think there's a better awareness now of what our typical authentic street food is. I mean, it's so cliche to always say authentic.
Well, what does authenticity mean?
What does it mean? To me, it means that something you actually grew up on. And you don't change it just to suit, you think what the customer's palates will be. It's more like you bring to your customers what you have grown up on, you know. I mean, just like this dress itself. I feel a bit overdressed, sorry guys. But this is exactly what it is. Like, this is a melting pot of our food in Malaysia. And even Malaysians are Chinese. We are overseas Chinese. But our grandparents, and I'm second generation in Malaysia, our grandparents came all the way from China, you know, so they brought their food with them. Like, we still eat a lot of herbal things, but we use spices in our soup. It makes sense that, like, we put cinnamon and cardamoms, star anise in our soup, just like, you know, some of your neuro men, you know. Yeah, but we still eat noodles, you know. So, yeah, it's a fusion of the Malay, the Chinese, and the Indians. So, yeah, so if you eat the curry, some of our curries are Indian influence. The roti definitely is, you know.
Yeah.
And the nasi lemak is the Malay, the locals in Malaysia. So it is a fusion of food. And when we talk about authenticity, I mean, when we first started Little Penang, there was a group of young students, university students, who came over to eat. And they started laughing and giggling nonstop. And I was like, something is really funny. Can I know why? Because it was a little tiny takeaway. And they said, oh, we're just talking about how we remember eating the nasi lemak during school breaks. And we used to wrap it in banana leaves and newspaper to make it into a triangle. Mm. Simple food, just the rice itself, a bit of sambal, a half-boiled egg, and the fried anchovies.
Yep.
But that brings back memories. And if you can do that to a customer, I feel then you're authentic. I still have customers sitting in, eating our food and say, oh my goodness, this reminds me of home. Mm-hmm. So that, to me, is what authenticity is. You know? Yeah.
Well, I mean, I remember the first time I ate Tommy Millions, and I was so obsessed with New York pizza, and I traveled to America a bunch with my band, and I loved New York pizza, and I was just like, man, the pizza in New Zealand sucks. I hate it. And not like, it's, you know, wood-fired pizzas in New Zealand were good, but in terms of getting a slice, you know, it was never any good. And then I remember having my first bite of Tommy's and just going, oh, this is the actual New York pizza. This is real. And it was so transportative. And then I've just been such a loyal customer since, because of that one moment of memory just imprinted in my mind that this is the real thing. But authenticity is complicated, right? I mean, Rick, you know, Solshak, you know, you're not American, but it's authentic to you, right? Because you believe in it.
Yep.
I think that's a real thing with food these days and with appropriation. It's only misappropriation if you're doing it because you're trying to make a quick buck. You're not doing it because you believe in the food story behind it, I guess.
Yeah. Well, like, you know, I mean, this year's been really interesting. You know, we had, you know, the whole Black Lives Matter kind of thing. So, you know, we try to kind of touch our food on and give kind of like credit to those roots and stuff that are part of the thing. But I think your team really touched on it and stuff. And I mean, it's in kind of your brand as well, with Taste of Home. You know, you kind of want to create, it's not just the food items that are important, you know, it's that, you know, that kind of like, oh, what do I remember about kind of food, and what kind of means. And you want to try and share this with people and have them kind of like, you know, just take a slice of that kind of like that culture, that flavor, that feeling of nostalgia that they had and stuff, you know. I mean, it's in the same with like, I'll go back on my gumbo, even though I do fried chicken, but like, you know, we have comments all the time like, oh, it just reminded me when I was back in, like, you know, the bayou and all that kind of jazz. So we touch on those little memories and stuff that are really important and stuff. And, you know, we've had people come in and try our Nashville hot chicken, and then they, you know, they compare it to other places and stuff. And I think what's important is that, like, you know, food is different to different people, you know, like, and it's okay to like something and not like something. You know, it's such a broad range. I mean, the experience I have at Little Penang and Taste of Home and Tommy's will be completely different to somebody else's experience, but, like, it's just as relevant, you know. I mean, and that's what's awesome about food, is that, you know, like, one of my barbecue heroes is a guy called Meathead and stuff. And, I mean, he his saying is that, like, you know, it's not what's on the table, it's who's at the table. And sometimes those people and those experiences that are shared, you know, that's what really makes it. Like, you had the group come in, they were just everything was about, like, you know, their school thing. And it brings that kind of slice of experience into their place and stuff. And I think that's what we all aim for. I think we all aim to give that experience to people, you know, in our own way. And, that's why I'm not a big believer in reviews. I think, you know, I think they just, you know, people are, it's okay to have your opinion about food. And it's, you know, it's food at the end of the day. And, like, we're here just to enjoy it and eat it. And we just all want to serve food and, you know, make people happy. I think that's my kind of, like, opinion about it anyway.
So, yeah, you know, for sure. Well, I remember the first time going to Little Penang, speaking of first experiences, because It was what when you first opened. I think Jeremy Taylor from Slow Boat took me there. Yeah. He's been your biggest champion.
Yeah.
Probably all of you guys, actually. So he took me there, and we started ordering things, and then we kept ordering more and more things. Yeah. You know, we had like a meal, and then we're like halfway through the first meal, and we're like, I think we better order another meal. Yeah. And then you just started bringing us all these free things because you were still experimenting with stuff, and you were like, I'm making this, try this, I'm making this, and here, have the dessert. And
yeah.
You know, and you have those experiences in a restaurant where you feel like you're actually participating with the staff in some kind of happening, you know, and then that becomes the so much more than just a meal, because yes. you're really all doing something together. Mm. And you know, Tommy's can feel like that at 1 o'clock in the morning when it's still the drunk, you know, the drunk crew and the staff are making jokes and they're just everything's getting, you know, they're slinging slices as fast as can be. And at that point, it's probably less about the food and it's more about the atmosphere. I guess. Now, how much time have we got? We've got a little bit more. Should we ask some questions? Does anyone want to ask any questions? Is that what we do in this situation? Or not so much? Yeah, okay, great. Have we got any questions for these guys from the no New Zealand crowd?
So, Tommy, you pressure the grill.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's right.
And everything's on the grill and salt shack. Is there some like if you print chicken and fry going on the grill?
No, we cook everything to order. And yeah. so that tends to be why the wait times are kind of quite long during lunch service. And we do our best to kind of communicate to people like it's going to be like, and sometimes you get it wrong. Like sometimes I'll go, oh, there's a 20-minute wait. And people go, okay. And then what can happen sometimes is that like if the order, sometimes an order, because we have an association with the Birdcage Bar next door, if an order comes through sometimes as well, it can really blow the orders out or just, you know, something like that. So... Yeah, and the thing with Nashville hot chicken is that, like, the way it's made, it has to be almost freshly cooked for the spices to adhere and for the... Because if it's not, if it's cooled, I mean, it kind of goes really, really super greasy and stuff. So it's just part of the chemistry that we have to kind of cook to order and stuff. And, I mean, people wait for fish and chips. They'll wait for Subway. They'll wait for Chinese food. They'll wait for everything. But when it comes to fried chicken, it's like... I need to have it now.
They want to go. They're used to going into Mr. Bun.
Yeah,
sitting there in a warmer.
That's exactly right. And I feel like there is a kind of like you almost say a misconception that like oh well chicken needs to be done immediately. Oh, I can cook the chicken, but it'll be uncooked and stuff when you get it. So we want to make sure that it's there and it's ready and stuff. And like I said, we try to communicate the wait times. We don't always get it right. Sometimes a 40-minute wait can blow up to an hour. But we haven't had too much complaint from that, and people seem to be really understanding, and I think that's just representative of Wellington, really. Yeah, awesome. It's all good. Thank you very much.
Yeah. I'd wait for any of these meals. Any other questions?
Why is it that a consistent complaint from my Cordon Bleu students from Malaysia and Singapore is that the Malaysian Food Day strike in Wellington is consistently too sweet?
Why is Malaysian food in Wellington so sweet?
Malaysian food in Wellington is so sweet. I can't speak for the rest of the Malaysian restaurants, I guess.
No,
but definitely not at Little Penang, because sugar is one of the items that is, you know, stays on the inventory for a long time before we reorder. I guess like places like we have Indonesian, a bit of Indonesian influence in terms of the sweet desserts and all that. But even that, we try to keep it the sugar level low, and we don't use a lot of sugar in our cooking, just because I think the Indonesians probably have a sweeter tooth than us. Sometimes some of the customers do ask us for a bit of extra sugar on the side, and then we were like, who is that customer? Where is that customer? You know, like, yeah. Because we believe that that's how the food should taste, but then we still, at the end of the day, have to respect the customers. If they want it sweeter, we give them sweeter. Like,
I mean, I feel like there's two clear things there, which is that the curry dishes you get at most Malaysian restaurants in Wellington feel like they're slightly influenced by the Indian dishes you get in Wellington, which I think that there were more Indian restaurants earlier than Malaysian restaurants, and New Zealand Indian food is very sweet and very creamy. So you tend to get a creamier kind of curry, and I think that's just catering to the market. And then the other thing is that some of the noodle dishes you get in Malaysian restaurants feel like they're in some way influenced by a pad thai, because again, that's kind of a familiar touch point, and pad thai should be sweet, right?
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily that they're coming here and tasting something that's like sweet Malaysian. What they're tasting is a dish that's designed for Victoria University students coming down the hill and wanting a $9 meal and wanting it to be familiar. That's what it's there for, and it does a good job doing it. But I think that you just have to tell your Cordon Bleu students to go to Little Penang.
Yeah.
Or maybe go to Pandan out in Lower Hutt is another one that I think is really great. There's lots of great spots around the place. But
I think the sources and all that we use is also important, which is why until today we import. In fact, we just had a shipment that came in with 8 pallets of our soy sauce, dark soy sauce and all that, because we know where it is made. We know how it tastes. We ran out once and we went to the Asian supermarket, and you're right, it was sweet. Like soy sauce are not meant to be sweet, but it was, just because it's not from Malaysia. talking about the food, that we don't compromise when it comes to the quality of the food. Yeah, if we rather tell them, sorry, we ran out. We did run out of mee goreng for almost like 5 days, and some of the customers just like had withdrawal syndromes, like, when is it coming? Just because you'll be surprised, even the Maggi Mee sauce, okay, now you know one of the ingredients. Right? The Maggi Mee sauce we use, we buy from Malaysia, it's different from the one you get from here.
Yeah.
Just like you try our Milo, it tastes different from the Milo in New Zealand. So,
I think we're going to wrap up in a second. I want one, just a quick answer from all of you. What do you want to see in terms of street food, everyday food in Wellington? What do you want to eat that you can't get here currently?
More like barbecue skewers, you know, just sit outside on a stool, have beers, and then someone's just cooking skewers for you.
Yeah, like yakitori or Indonesian or just...
It's more like Chinese style, you know, the one with the Szechuan pepper and then the chili powder on top.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really nice, yeah.
Funny, there was a chef who was good at Szechuan food who could maybe...
but then my permit doesn't allow me to have a barbecue. I'd love to have one.
And tea, is there something?
Yeah, I think it's the same thing. Like, there are restrictions here. Like, we really want to create the ambience and, you know, like back home, where we just lay out tables on the roadsides and all that, you know.
Yeah.
I park my car for 5 minutes to unload things. I have council after me. Yeah. So I can't do that with the food. But that is the kind of, my hope is that we have like a big hawker center. That's what we call them, you know, hawker center. Not the food court, air conditioned in the building. In the open space where people can dine and choose what they want, and you know,
Tommy?
The specific answer, having traveled there most recently, would be to see some quality northern Vietnamese food. But the more general answer would be to continue the trend that we're seeing from places like Taste of Home and Little Penang, where chefs who might have been born somewhere else but now in New Zealand have the confidence to cook the food that they want to cook and season it the way that they want to cook it, season it, and have confidence that there's a market for that and it will be appreciated, and they don't have to add cream and sugar or whatever to make it pleasing to Wellingtonians. So anything that ticks those boxes, and shorter menus.
Shorter menus, specific menus.
From a place, from the heart, is what I would like to see in Wellington street food.
Yeah. Rick?
Yeah, I think kind of along the same lines. I think I'd like to see kind of that just smaller kind of, very casual style kind of like food and stuff, you know, that's really just really, really focused.
Specific,
you know, like
not Pan-Asian, but specific.
No, just kind of like they do one thing or two things just really, really well, and you just kind of go there, you know, like good, just like a casual, say, like a barbecue, kind of like chopped up kind of pork, you know, that kind of stuff, I think. That'd be the way to go. Not, I don't know if our demographics would support that, but it's just, that's good. Cheap meat's great.
Great.
One of my dreams is to actually see a center where we can have seafood. Just like you go to a seafood center, and then you can, I want this barbecue, I want this grill, I want this whatever. Like, we have that, a lot of that in Malaysia, you know, and in Southeast Asia, but nothing here.
Mm. Okay, round of applause for the wonderful chefs.
Thank you very much, Steve, T, Tommy, Rick, and of course Sam, for facilitating. That's been really fascinating. I think we all, particularly your ideas, been writing them down as sort of things that we could possibly do. I really enjoyed the discussion, particularly around authenticity. It's a discussion we have a lot. What is authentic food? But I think it's very clear from all of you and your commitment to the crafts that you are all so good at, that fine food isn't only found in fine dining restaurants, and that you are all incredibly committed to what you do and the lengths you've gone to research. If only everyone knew that. I think, you know, the stories are amazing. I'd also like to thank all of you for attending today. I see a number of familiar faces in the audience who've been to every single one of these sessions, so thank you very much for supporting the speaker series. I think we've already come away thinking with a lot of ideas for next year. I've had someone already say to me, can we have these every week? maybe not, we'll see. Thank you very much to Te Papa for their support. We really, really appreciate it. It's been fantastic working with you. So thank you and kia ora.
Thank you for listening to the special series of Honeycomb episodes in collaboration with Visa Wellington on a Plate. Wherever you listen to podcasts, please make sure you subscribe to hear future episodes.